Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Welcome. This is WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, 94.7. We are being progressive. Professor Sidney Milk is here with us. Catch your breath.
Sorry, man. I was on the other side.
Right? That's all right. We are here today. This is going to be one of the more interesting conversations that we've had in a while. Again, Professor Sidney Milk, you got your mic off. You can yell at them if you need something. Again, Professor Sidney Milkus here, UVA professor, Department of Politics, research focusing on the American presidency, political parties in the election, social movements, and American political development. Professor Milkus also earned a 4.5 out of 5, equivalent to awesome, on the Rate My Professor website. Welcome.
Good to be here, Rick. Sorry for the... A slight delay.
Well, you know, it allowed me to learn something about on exactly what progressive means behind the wheel of a car to to a modern black woman, at least here at WPVC. Don't get in the way of Leslie Scott Jones. And you know, we were planning this Sunday, and of course, you know, we start planning this. I think I was looking back. I sent you an email back in August. And, of course, that means nothing to current events. And then you wake up on whatever day, Friday morning, and you find out that Donald Trump, something that happened in 2005, comes out. And like, oh, well, that'll be interesting. We can talk about that on Sunday. So, you know, I had put this... I had sort of given the topic of today's show, what makes the 2016 presidential election unique. Because everyone has, that has been the conversation for quite some time now, about that this presidential election is so different. Because we have our first female candidate for one of the two major parties. Because Donald Trump is such a different candidate, correct? He doesn't really have, for one of the two parties, he is not a lifelong or a long-term politician.
Yeah, I mean, he's been hovering around politics for a long time, but his career is mainly as a businessman. And I think most interesting, Rick, for this campaign is his experience in reality TV, being the star of a reality TV show, being not just a businessman but a celebrity. And a lot of celebrities in American politics have backgrounds that can lead to revelations that might prove embarrassing. And I think we've seen a bit of that throughout this campaign. But boy, it certainly has blown up since Friday. As you said,
well, you sent me some paperwork to read, sort of as my preparation, and in that you said
there'll be no test.
No test, thank goodness. Well, maybe that's why you get a 4.5 out of 5 on the Rate My Professor website. You said this is the rare election that is of great historical importance, one that determines the future course of American democracy.
Yeah.
Why do you think that that's the case?
Well, see, because there's been so much emphasis on the personalities of the candidates, crooked Hillary versus the basket of deplorables. But that's deflected attention from some really important differences between the parties. Remember, we don't just have a presidential election going on, Rick. We have a very important congressional elections as well. And when you look at the whole picture, there's tremendous differences between the parties on the whole gamut of issues, economic issues, social issues, foreign policy issues. And, You know, I think, Rick, this is the first time in maybe 10 years, but it might be longer than that, that immigration has been a major issue that the American people are focusing on. And I think there the differences couldn't be more stark between the candidates. Hillary Clinton, the Democrats, taking a kind of global view and a view that the major demographic shifts in the country are good for the country. This is a kind of a longstanding defense of immigration, how it enriches our culture, how it adds dynamism to our economy, the Statue of Liberty symbolizing that. And the Republicans being focusing very, very heavily on a negative attitude towards undocumented workers and building a wall. And this is carried over to Homeland Security, which is another huge issue in American politics. And Donald Trump's opposition to the entrance of Muslims into our country and refugees, and the Democrats and Hillary Clinton's general support of that. So I think we could spend the whole hour just talking about the critical differences. We could just go down the list of things that the American people care about, including what my students care a whole lot about the cost of education. And I think the worldviews of the parties are as different now as perhaps they've ever been in at least a recent American history.
When we have our first female major party candidate.
We sure do, yeah.
Is she being treated differently?
You know, I think so. I think, you know, I was thinking about two sort of unconventional women and their controversial roles in politics as I was trying to find your radio station today. As I was hanging out at the Burger King. I was wandering around Burger King looking for you.
The big sign is by the dumpster.
Yeah, if I couldn't find the door. But anyway, I was thinking about Eleanor Roosevelt and Hillary Clinton, who are both really sort of unconventional first ladies, in that they, you know, didn't take on the role of sort of nonpartisan spouse, but have got involved in very important issues with Eleanor Roosevelt, civil rights, with Hillary Clinton, health care. And that is an unconventional view for women in the role of first ladies, to be very active in a controversial policy debates. But it's also an issue for women in politics in general. And I think all these criticisms you've heard throughout the campaign about how Hillary Clinton dresses, about how she shouts, how she relates to people, I think clearly that is the country coming to terms with the fact that we have the first woman running as a major party nominee for the presidency.
And she's not standing behind the man wearing her frock and politely curtsying when the other men enter the room.
She's tough as nails, and I think people, at least in this country, you know, and it's interesting, Europe, where they've had kings and queens for centuries ago, they're more used to tough women engaging in politics. It's more of an acquired taste.
Right. We have Muslim countries that have female leadership.
Yeah.
Right. And we've had Pakistan, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think some of that might go back to the fact that they have feudal traditions in those countries. So they're used to women playing a prominent role in their political arenas. It's always been a little more acquired taste in the United States. But I think your point about standing behind her man, I mean, you may remember how controversial it was when Hillary Clinton was involved in things like health care, and she was getting some criticism.
Right. She seemed to be, other than Eleanor Roosevelt, she seemed to be at least, in a well-known sense, one of the first ladies to say, I would like to put forth some some ideas of things to be done.
Yeah, I don't want to be. What, remember her famous line? I could just stay home and bake cookies.
Right.
But that's not what I'm about.
There were probably some other first ladies who had ideas, but they slipped them to their to their husbands when they were getting ready for bed at night.
Yeah, but she was. Bill Clinton viewed her as a partner in his White House. Now, I think one of the most fascinating dynamics of this campaign, which should be might play a role in this evening's debate, is the reversal of roles here. So she's running for president, and Bill Clinton is the first dude.
My wife asked me last night, "What is he going to do?
What's he going to do?
Right? What's he going to do with with Michelle Obama's garden? What's going to happen? What's going to happen with that if they win?"
I think he's promised to keep it up. Now, whether that promise is fulfilled, Rick, we'll have to see. But won't it be interesting tonight? Because we have a desperate Donald Trump being attacked for this tape of from 2005, and I think his inclination is to strike out. So there's been talk about him striking out against Bill Clinton's indiscretions, and it'll be interesting if she gives a form of an answer that says Bill Clinton is not running for president. I am running for president of the United States, and I think this kind of thing connects to your original question, Rick, about a woman running for president for the first time. Is she to be more responsible for her husband's past than a man would be for his spouse's past, were he running for president?
UVA Professor Sidney Milk is here today as we're talking about the 2016 presidential election and some of the issues that make it unique. Make it different. Certainly, many of us would say a little different than the ones that we've seen in the past. Sid, as we get up this morning and check out the news online, on our iPads, in the newspaper, the video that's come forth in the last day or two about Mr. Trump and his raw language from 2005, more elected Republican officials are saying, "I cannot vote for this man. I will not vote for this man.
Yeah.
I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton, but I'm not going to vote for Donald Trump."
Yeah, including the Republican nominee of 2008, John McCain.
John McCain. Arnold Schwarzenegger has said.
The third-ranking member of the Senate, John Thune from South Dakota, has come out and said he's not going to support him. Arnold Schwarzenegger said Terminator is not going to vote for him.
But we've gone from some people that you have to be somewhat maybe locally or in your state known, the guy from Utah, the guy from Kansas, that you may not know in Virginia. You may not know the name of the guy, some guy from Utah, some guy from Kansas, some guy from the which Dakota? But but if you know anything at all, John McCain, that name. You certainly know Arnold Schwarzenegger. So
you know George Bush.
That's correct.
George H.W. Bush.
And so we've gone from the B level, at least in terms of notoriety, to the A level names are now stepping away from supporting him. Have we ever let's go to your political history, is this unique in the sense of the nominee being asked to step down?
I don't think it's, it's hard when you study a lot of presidential history to say anything is unique. So, I mean, there are interesting parallels.
Rare.
I'll give you rare. You pass with rare. I don't think you have to go back too far to see defections like this. When Barry Goldwater ran in 1964, at that time, the center of the Republican Party was moderate. It was, and that moderate wing was led by Nelson Rockefeller, a very prominent governor from New York. And he opposed Barry Goldwater's nomination, and there was a kind of a front lash movement in the Johnson campaign to get Republicans to support him. But that split was one of ideology. That was a split between a kind of emerging conservative movement that eventually would sort of t- take control of the Republican Party. And the moderates who felt that that kind of opposition was outside the mainstream of American politics. What's different and a little bizarre about this campaign, Rick, is that Donald Trump's, the people splitting off from Donald Trump, in part, some of it is ideology. Some people like Bill Kristol, who's head of the very important conservative magazine Weekly Standard, is very put off by his foreign policy and his talk about abandoning things, organizations like NATO. But I think a lot of it has to do, Rick, as you were suggesting, about his qualifications, Donald Trump's qualifications to be president. Does he pass, if I can put it most crudely, the smell test so that we can put this man in the highest office in the land? Now, this has haunted him throughout his campaign, because what we're seeing now is kind of a culmination of things that have been going on throughout the campaign. But that's different, and it in a way poses more of a threat to his candidacy than the opposition of moderate Republicans did to Goldwater's candidacy. And I also think it's a deep-rooted issue for the Republic. One has to ask a question. You know, when you watch this, Rick, if this was a movie, wouldn't you say, wow, this is so exaggerated? And, you know, you can't make this stuff up that's been going on in this campaign. So one has to wonder about what this tells us about the state of American democracy, that we're obsessed with a tape that with disgusting language and claims on it the night before a major presidential debate where 70 million American people are going to be watching.
Well, one of the things that I found, and I think that this is, and you're right, because you never know exactly what to, you know, where's the truth and what is the satire?
Yeah, yeah. What's Saturday Night Live?
Right, exactly.
What's reality?
The people who have stepped away from Donald Trump are all elected officials. And the ones that first stepped away from Donald Trump were the ones who had been elected officials and now weren't running anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most of the elected officials, although they've kept their distance from Trump, hoping, you know, they're real worried about the down-ticket races. The Republicans are going to have a very difficult time holding on to the Senate this time. There are a lot of races that are in blue districts, districts that states, excuse me, that that are difficult contests for Republicans, and so a lot of elected officials, Rick, as you suggested, have kept their distance, but have not said they wouldn't support Donald Trump. And I think for the most part, I was, you know, this is like trying to follow a bucking bronco event. So as I was heading out here today, I took a last glance at what was going on some of the sites that I get information from. And most of that's holding. So Paul Ryan, who's a very important figure in all this, Speaker of the House, very popular in the Republican Party, is kind of the de facto leader of the Republican Party, if you will. Refused to appear at an event in Wisconsin yesterday that with Donald Trump. They had a planned event in Wisconsin in his district, and he refused to meet with Trump. So Trump pulled out, and then Pence was going to go. Now he's an interesting figure in all this. We should talk about it. And then Pence pulled out of it. But for all that, Paul Ryan still has not said he's not going to vote for Donald Trump. So I think these guys are crafty, and they've sort of held their nose refused to abandon the Trump candidacy, thinking that would do more harm than good to their self-interest. I think they're going to let things play out a little bit. It'll be really interesting to see what happens this evening in the debate. If Donald Trump is viewed as a disaster in the debate again this evening, it'll look like the Titanic. I mean, people will really start, I think, to abandon ship.
Well, one of the things that I read, and again, you have to, it's difficult sometimes these days, unless you know you have faith in some of the websites as those websites being particularly truthful. They're not tied to one side or the other. But there is saying that support from not being from the general public, right? That after hearing about this video, the bawdy Trump video, is that the general public Republicans, Trump's percentage only dropped 1%. It's only the elected officials who are running away from him, or who are, you know, stepping back a little bit, sort of checking to see where things go. The folks who have already decided that that's who they're voting for are saying, well, you know, what am I supposed to do? Because my other options, or they're saying, I don't care.
Yeah. When they weigh these indiscretions, or the, what did you call it, the body tape?
The body tape. No, that was B-A-W-D-Y, not B-O-D-Y.
When they view that against the prospects of, the untenable prospect of seeing Hillary Clinton president, then they swallow these character flaws of Donald Trump. And that has... that has been the case, and I think the figures you poll you just showed, I saw that too. I suggest that even this, Rick, may not change that. What's really been interesting is the relationship between Donald Trump and the Christian right, and some of the most and even Donald Trump admitted he's gotten great support from them. But he's not sure why, given his past. But the most outspoken leaders, say, around the country that I heard defending Donald Trump this morning were leaders of the Christian right.
One of the other parts in one of the later paragraphs on that same poll that I saw was that they were talking about whether or not the people in taking this poll was how bothered were you by the tape?
Yeah.
Were you... not bothered at all? Were you somewhat bothered? Were you completely disgusted? And 10% of the Republicans said that it actually gave them a positive feeling about Trump.
I don't know if we should go to that 10%.
Well,
doesn't this fit the kind of locker room bravado that's been part and parcel of his campaign? I mean, if you had told me 20%, Rick, I don't know that I'd been that surprised. Because machismo, you know, that's been a big part of his campaign. There's been a huge difference in his support between men and women.
Well, let's talk about Trump as a populist. Let's go back to you know, get away from some of this part that we can't explain too much.
Yeah.
But go back to a little bit more academic
part. Oh, shucks, Rick, this is more fun.
But we'll go back and forth a little bit. Again, our guest today, Professor Sidney Milkus from Department of Politics at UVA. We are talking about some of the things that make the 2016 presidential election unique, unusual, special. Trump is viewed as a populist. And some of the others, Huey Long from the past, Charles Lindbergh, Joe McCarthy, George Wallace, you described those as all disruptive, but none of them succeeded in capturing the nomination.
Right. And one of the questions will... political scientist who study things like this rather than body tapes will be asking ourselves for a long time is, how did this happen? An understanding about American politics, this kind of populist nationalism which is imbued with a certain amount of nativism and views many of the changes that have taken place in American politics to make us a more diverse society with hostility. How does that move from the margins to the mainstream in American politics. And Rick, I spend a lot of time speaking abroad and speaking to international public officials and scholars, and they're particularly curious about this because this tradition has always had an important place in Europe. And you could make an interesting parallels between the Brexit vote in Britain.
Well, the fringe is always there.
Right. But how did a country that has always been celebrated as for its pragmatism, for its vital center, for its strong constitutional government, how does a movement like this move to the mainstream? And I think that's a question we'll be struggling with for a really long time.
I had no idea. It's 11:27 already. Let me take the break that I'm supposed to take at 20 minutes after
time
the
flies when you're having fun,
it's
doesn't it?
It's true. I'm fascinated by these conversations. It's a beautiful, sunny fall day outside. I hope you're enjoying it all by listening to the radio. Sunday morning wake-up call, 94.7 WPVC. Professor Sidney Milk is here with us trying to explain what the hell is going on out there in the 2016 presidential election. All right, back in action with Professor Milkus here. You know, we talked about Trump being a populist. He runs as a businessman, and that's why he's an outsider. That's one of the things that makes him a populist, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Correct. But as a businessman, he says he's successful. But again, he's never released his tax records. That's come up in the past week or two. We often hear that he's the first presidential candidate who hasn't released his tax records in over 50-plus years. Who was the last one who didn't do that? And why didn't they? Do you know?
I think it was Nixon who refused to release them in 68, but he did release them in 72.
Do we know why he didn't release them in 68? Did they eventually come out? Did we find the secret, or was he just
He was just being Nixon. There was no particular secret about it.
Do you think that the tax records for Trump are hurting him in any way?
And
we know what Hillary Clinton, people who are listening today probably watched the first debate, and they know that Hillary Clinton bashed him a little bit on you not paying anything, you're not helping the schools, you're not helping the veterans, you're not helping, those lines that she made. Do you think that?
Yeah, and your claims to be a great businessman who's going to bring those skills to America are fraudulent. I think that was a very successful line of attack. I mean, there aren't, we've reached a stage of the campaign, Rick, and we're in a kind of, this goes back to what we were talking about before, and most Republicans sticking with Trump even after the body tape, where there aren't that many undecideds. And so what this election, I think, mainly depends on is mobilizing your base. And Hillary Clinton has had a bit of a problem doing that. In fact, if I've looked at polls that suggest Donald Trump supporters are much more enthusiastic about him than Hillary Clinton supporters are about her. I mean, they have a certain amount of respect for her. They certainly see her as a better alternative than Trump. But Trump supporters see him as part of a movement that they're following. So I think this attack on Trump's mysterious business life, made more mysterious by the fact he won't release his tax returns, I think did help her solidify her support among the base, and a lead that kind of had evaporated from that campaign bounce she got to the time of the first debate has come back, and so she's about 4 percentage points up. Now, there were other things in that debate, obviously, that were very important, some that were precursors to the body tape, like the misogyny she brought out at the very end of
the Machado.
The Machado. Yep. But I think you're right. You're on point that this claim to be a man of the people and a great businessman who's going to be the voice of the people. I do think that argument is compromised by the fact that he seems so reluctant to reveal the record of his business.
I agree with you completely about who.
That's got to be a first time. Right? You've agreed with me completely.
Who are these people who are undecided? When you see that in the polls, that it's whatever the current number is, it's 45% for Hillary Clinton and 40% for Trump, and then it's X percent for Stein and X percent for
what
Johnson.
Is it, 5-2?
But there
like
seems
7%.
To be like, right, it seems to be like 7% undecided.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who are these people who haven't decided? And I think it's I just don't know what they're undecided about.
Well, since the political system's really gotten polarized, and I think one can take this back to the Iraq War. This really seemed to divide the country in a way that's carried forward to today. 7%'s about been the number as we get to this part of the campaign, Rick. But I haven't studied this in detail, but you and I, maybe we'll do it. We'll study this after our show today.
I'm on your side.
But I think the independents are a little different this time. And the people haven't chosen. In the past, they've been people who've been not paying attention, outside of politics, not paying attention to what's going on. I saw a report the other day that suggested, not this time, that these 7% are people who have paid very careful attention to the campaign, are riveted by it, but simply find both candidates so unappealing. And another unprecedented part of this campaign, Rick, is since we've taken polls, we have never seen two candidates as unpopular as these two. Both of them are in the negative. And so when I look at polls every day, I just look at who's viewed more negatively than the other. And right now, Donald Trump's viewed by about 11 has about 11% lead on Secretary Clinton on being disliked. And so I think that those 7% are trying to decide whether they can hold their nose and vote for one of these candidates because they don't particularly like either one, or whether they will vote for one of the minor party candidates, this time Gary Johnson or Jill Stein. And what always happens in these campaigns, and it's happening now, is you'll see movement as the campaign, as we get closer to voting day in a close campaign, as people will move away from Johnson and Stein towards one of the candidates. And to this point, that seems to be helping Hillary Clinton. Now, 7% may not sound a lot, but in a campaign like this, it's everything. You know, when a lead goes from 2 to 4%, you go, wow, that's really momentum in this campaign.
I'm also a firm believer that when somebody calls you on the phone and asks you who you're voting for, you don't, especially in this case, because as you mentioned with Trump and Clinton, they're disliked. And so for a large percentage or a healthy percentage of the population, you're somewhat embarrassed to say who you might vote for. And so you may not give an answer, a truthful answer of who you're going to vote for once you're alone in the poll situation, you know, once you're alone to who you actually push the button for.
Yeah, I think we should be very wary of polls. The only thing that I teach at a university where supporting Trump is very, very even more controversial than it is outside a university setting. And I say to myself, I'm sure there's some people here who support Trump that they're closet Trump supporters. They just don't.
Right.
So on the Democratic side, this isn't a matter of not wanting to admit your support, but it's very hard to gauge the support of for example, Latinos, who always, I think, are underpolled, and also don't vote in the numbers that would really fulfill their political effectiveness. But I think that the matter of Trump support is particularly hard to gauge this campaign. The only thing that makes me feel a little more confident, Rick, is sites like Real Clear Politics, if I can just give them a call out, they take average polls. So they'll take a look at like five major polls and take the average. And when I look down at a number of different polls, there are some differences, but there's definitely a definite trends that one can make some sense of. So I do think it's the case that Hillary Clinton's up right now by about 4%. But that's, we're talking about we're 3%, you know, margin of error here. So
yeah,
it's still a very close.
Yes,
election.
It's very frightening. 11:37 here.
In political science, as a scholar, we say it's still very close. We don't say it's frightening.
You don't say it's frightening.
That's a judgment.
But here on the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville,
we can say that's frightening.
We can say it,
yeah.
94.7 WPVC. This is the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. An exciting chat with the show's friend, Professor Sidney Milkus, UVA professor.
That's exciting to be here with you, Rick. Always so fun.
Great. I appreciate that. So let's look into the future a little bit. And let's say that Hillary Clinton does win.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, and then talk about how Donald Trump... You know, we've talked already about how Donald Trump, to many of us, was a surprising nominee.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we step back and talk about the day that he came down the escalator, everybody said, oh, he won't be here long.
Yeah.
And, every time he passed another hurdle, they said, oh, but he won't be here the next hurdle.
Yeah.
Oh, he won't be here the next hurdle. Is this the time when the Republican Party fractures and makes a change? You can look at in the 1960s that the Republican Party flipped? I mean, was it in the 60s that the Republican Party actually sort of represented, or in the 50s when the Republican Party represented the group that now sort of represents, is made up in the Democratic Party? There was a time period.
For a long time, although it starts really before the 50s, when African Americans supported
the Republican Party.
That goes back to the Civil War, of course. That began to flip with the Franklin Roosevelt's progressive program in the 1930s. But Roosevelt never supported a strong civil rights program. It's not until the 60s, Rick, that African Americans really become decided Democrats.
And then the Whig Party. I mean,
the Whig Party. Now we're really getting back into
deep. But there are parties that existed for decades that disappear altogether because major events happen that lead to their demise.
Yeah. The Civil War and slavery is what did end the Whig Party.
So is this an event where a person gathers the nomination, the party becomes the party itself
divides dragged down
over the nomination and the events that happen leading up to the election? Are we witnessing a major change to the Republican Party?
Or the destruction. That's deep history, Rick, referring to the Whig Party.
I had to go back to my Wikipedia.
I don't think the Republican Party's going to follow the same fate of the Whig Party. The most clear reason for that is, although even if they lose this presidential election, they're still very strong in the Congress and the state and local level. I mean, one of the ironies or paradoxes of the Obama presidency has been he was reelected to a second term, and now he's a very popular president.
He's one of the most popular presidents
the way out the door, very well put. Last poll I saw was something like 55% approval rating. But even as that, he's been, pretty popular and effective president. The Democrats have lost support in the Congress in record numbers. You have to go back to the 1950 and Eisenhower's administration to see a president's party do so badly during his tenure. So the Republicans are strong in the Congress still. They're not going to lose the House. They may lose the Senate. And how many governorships do they? I don't have the number at my fingertips, but it's high. It's like 30. They control a lot of state legislators. So they've got a strong base. And the Whigs were the opposite. The pyramid was turned the other way around. The Whigs had very little grassroots support, a very weak foundation. they'd been doing badly in
state. Also, what did they? They had two presidents. They got elected and they died.
And they both died. So even God, even God was against them.
Thank you, Wikipedia.
Yeah, William. Now I could ask you: William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor, the two Whigs elected for president, both died. So even God was against the Whigs. So, you know, so I don't know if that's the case with the Republicans. Maybe after the body tape.
We'll see.
But the more interesting question is: what effect will Trump have on what will be his lasting legacy? Will he be a comet who you know?
Did you say comic?
Comet? No, I didn't. I didn't mean to say. I meant comet.
Comet.
As in the sky, we see it go, and it's a blaze of glory. Or will he have like an enduring legacy as Barry Goldwater? And Barry Goldwater lost very bad in '64, but that was the beginning of he was the leader of a conservative movement that Ronald Reagan was also an important member of, that eventually became a major force in American politics. Will that be the fate of Donald Trump's
that he forces the Republicans
kind of authoritarian populism?
Because they were talking the last time about how they, after Obama's return to power, that they had to, what were they going to make their... Bible is in my head, but they were going to put together their... You know, their
covenant,
but they were going to get all their paperwork together, and this is how we're going to do things. Yeah. This is what we're going to do to get the Latino vote.
Yeah,
this
they did a postmortem. It was called a postmortem, actually. And the biggest issue was immigration, because the demographics.
And they didn't do anything.
They did the opposite. They took a more visceral position against immigration and undocumented workers. So they went in the opposite direction of what they had plan to do. So many of that's a very good point. I'm going to give you an A for today's show. Awesome. You've mentioned the Whigs, but this is a development that's been going on within the Republican base for a long time. Remember, Mitt Romney took a very conservative position on immigration, and the Latino vote probably decided the 2012 election, the fact that President Obama won over 70% of the Latino vote. So certain things Donald Trump tapped into, he didn't create. But I think one place where a lot of Republicans are very concerned is how this populist authoritarianism would affect our standing in the world. And there they've been very concerned about about Trump saying that he would abandon or threatening to abandon alliances like NATO. And so I think some conservative and establishment Republicans are hopeful that at least the foreign policy positions and the extremely visceral nativist positions Donald Trump has expressed will not stay with the party after the election. But whether that'll happen is a really difficult question to answer, Rick, because a lot of these developments that now solidify the Republican base have been developing over for the last couple of decades.
11:45 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Professor Sidney Milkus from the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. Hang tight. Be right back. All right, back in action here with Sidney Milkus.
We're in action mode.
We are in action mode. Like Donald Trump. Donald Trump is always in action mode, and many people say that's what really one of the things that causes him trouble. If I had to do this 1 hour all the time, I don't know how many horrible mistakes I would make.
Yeah.
With my brain to my tongue all the time.
Yeah, well, you're a man of good character, Rick. I don't think we'd have to worry about
people
you.
Might misjudge that and say you're wrong if I had to be speaking with cameras in front of my face all the time and feel the need to always be, you know, sound like people want, you know, I need to say something that seems worthwhile all the time. And I think he feels the need, even before he was running for president.
And to lash back at his accusers.
Yeah, that's his own issue.
If I was a member of his family or part of his campaign team and his members of his family are very important. I'd get a hold of that phone where he sends those tweets and smash it and hide it. But, you know, social media has been both his great strength in this campaign and his great vulnerability. So, I mean, it's his way. You called him a populist, and I've referred to him as a populist, and maybe we're misusing that word. But that's one of the way he connects with his supporters who are very loyal to him. That's the way he's connecting to him primarily now in this very treacherous part of his campaign. So, you know, that cuts both ways for him.
Yeah.
Whether he would have been the nominee without this social media, if we take it beyond tweets and the other part, is a serious question.
That's one of the things that gets, you know, Arnold, I think it was Schwarzenegger that I read, you know, in just this last 24 hours as Arnold Schwarzenegger, one of the people who said, I can't support him anymore as the nominee of my party. He says, America is more important than the Republicans.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I had come up with in preparing for the show is that if you're going to vote for the party and you're going to vote for Donald Trump because he has the R at the end of his name, what are we sending out to the world to see tens of millions of people voting for him as the president because there are so many things attached to him? And I understand that it works both ways for people, tens of millions of people voting for Hillary Clinton because she has the Democratic symbol for her. If you believe all the stories put out there, oh, well, she's a murderer because of Benghazi. Mm-hmm.
She's crooked. She's a...
Right, one of the later...
She should be locked up because of her emails.
That's right.
Wasn't that the sign at the Republican?
One of the latest stories I saw was how there was a thing put up on Facebook, and I don't even know if these are true. Sometimes you see these things, but there was a little story told about how Trump went down to Haiti and gave some business to somebody in his family to help rebuild Haiti, and they made a profit on it, and then they left without even doing all the work.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, that was Hillary Clinton, you know, because it was put out there by Trump supporters.
Yeah.
You know, that was a way to support Trump. But when the rest of the world sees tens of millions of Americans supporting someone who we have known knowledge about for having acted in these ways, it's embarrassing.
Yeah, it is a great concern. I mentioned earlier, Rick, that I do a lot of lecturing abroad, and I spend a lot of time with international scholars and public officials here. I have 12 members of the British press coming to meet with me and talk about the election in a couple of weeks, and they are very concerned for a couple of reasons. One, this is a very powerful country. It has what happens here affects the rest of the world, and they're very, very worried at the prospect of Donald Trump occupying the Oval Office. And then there's a more poignant reason, which I found sort of moving, in that a lot of these international officials, particularly those from developing countries, say they've looked at America as kind of the lodestar, you know, a kind of stable constitutional democracy that protected individual rights, that had a strong vital center that as a foundation of their democracy. And to see that fundamentally challenged by what's gone on in this election has disappointed them immensely. And they wonder, has this been fool's gold? This hope that we should look to America as the kind of democracy we want to be, when America has problems that plague our countries and in some ways seem worse than the problems that plague our country. So it really is interesting to look at how this election is not only playing out here, Rick, but has affected our place, has affected the way people outside of this country think of what's going on in American democracy.
One of the ways, or one of the big changes that happened, I believe, was in the 60s and 70s, about how the nominating process went from convention to primary system. And you believe that that was one of the reasons that Trump was allowed to, in the convention system, he would have never become the nominee, correct?
I think this is a point I've been trumpeting. Forgive the, no pun intended.
Clever.
There. But I don't think enough people are talking about it, and that, as you said, up until the 1970s, the nominees for president were chosen by presidential conventions held, you know, held every 4 years, that went back to the Jacksonian era, the 1830s. And these were convocations where public officials and state and local leaders deliberated or bargained and chose the nominee. And in a way, they act. There was the problem with these, from the view of some reformers, was that you could have deals struck in the behind closed doors,
right,
in the so-called smoke-filled room.
Right, that's the old back room with cigars.
Cigars. Now nobody can smoke in back rooms.
Yeah. That would be illegal.
So smoke-filled rooms are not a problem.
Right, that'd be illegal in the public.
When Humphrey got the nomination in 1968, although he didn't, you know, then we had a few primaries, but not enough to choose the nominee. That kind of launched the controversy of the Vietnam War. That launched reforms so that we still have the convention system, but overwhelmingly the delegates to those are chosen by primaries and caucuses. And so the Republican leaders, although most of them were desperately opposed to Trump, had no way of preventing his nomination, because basically the conventions have become reality shows or infomercials that promote the person who's been most successful in the primaries and the caucuses, which are a somewhat less participatory version of the primaries. And we could view Donald Trump as capturing the Republican Party. Now, to show you, to point to how the convention can play a positive role, and we should worry a little bit about how weak it's become, I point to the election of 1940, if I could just talk about that for a second. This was the time of the first American movement. Its hero was Charles Lindbergh, the pilot, you know, the first person to do the cross-Atlantic flight. There was no cult of personality, maybe even Roosevelt couldn't rival him in terms of cult of personality than Charles Lindbergh. And he was a sympathizer with Nazi Germany and anti-Semitic.
Just for our younger crowd, Charles Lindbergh flew across.
Yeah, first pilot person.
First pilot to fly across the Atlantic.
Yeah, there's a great movie they could watch on Netflix called The Spirit of St. Louis, with Jimmy Stewart playing Charles Lindbergh. And he was a great hero, but by 1940, he was a virulent isolationist who had sympathies for the Nazis and was anti-Semitic. If there were primaries then, I think he would have challenged seriously for the Republican nomination. But because of the convention system, the Republicans marginalized him in 1940 and nominated a businessman, which was unusual, Wendell Willkie. But Wendell Willkie was a pragmatic, a moderate businessman, something like a Michael Bloomberg would be viewed today. And in a critical moment, when Roosevelt moved us towards participation in World War II, after France had fallen, after only Britain remained, Wilkie supported, after the election, which Wilkie lost to Roosevelt, Wilkie supported Roosevelt's foreign policy. That was a critical moment in American history. It allowed us, as a unified country, to take on Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Without the convention system, if we had the primaries then, the situation might have been very different.
That's the original America First.
That's the first America First movement, yeah.
So who did Trump steal that line from? Did he steal it from Lindbergh? Did he steal it from Willkie?
Well, Willkie didn't use that term. That was Lindbergh. Willkie believed in some of the noble ideals that you were talking about before, the public good, you know, international justice. But I don't know if it was taken deliberately or it's just an accident. But, you know, Trump has a close relationship with John Bannon, who owns the Breitbart site, which is, I don't know if you've ever been on the Breitbart site, but it is what's called the center on the internet for the alt-right. And it's got some violently racist and anti-Semitic stuff on it.
I haven't been on there, and I'll say that I won't because I
have a stiff drink and go visit it. they referred to Bill Kristol, who's one of the Republicans,
right,
as the renegade Jew, and that's one of their milder stories.
Something that I really hadn't thought about until I read some of the papers that you forwarded to me. There's freedom from fear and there's freedom from want.
Yeah.
And I hadn't really thought about that as being the divide really between the two parties.
Yeah. Many people besides me have thought about it. This is a Milkinsonian way of viewing the world. but these are two new freedoms that Roosevelt proclaimed in his 1941 State of the Union message, to go along with our traditional freedoms like freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And given the new threats in the world to our domestic economy and our foreign policy, we needed to pronounce two new freedoms: freedom from want, which came to be embodied by the welfare state, and freedom from fear, which came to be embodied by the national security state and law and order. And so, in a way, what has caused a split in American politics is the Democrats now embrace overwhelmingly the freedom from want, where the Republicans have embraced freedom from fear. And you can see that playing out in this campaign. The term fear is a constant refrain of Donald Trump's campaign. And Hillary Clinton, not quite as much as Bernie Sanders, but Hillary Clinton has talked about the need to ameliorate the economic security of the American people, particularly those who are least fortunate in our society.
Do you think the Tea Party will have a bigger role? Has their star passed along? Or
I think the Tea Party's become kind of institutionalized. It's become part of the Republican Party, so they no longer have a disruptive effect in the Republican Party like they had beginning in 2009. But this anger of the base, this willingness of the base to support anyone but Hillary Clinton or anyone but a Democrat, I think that's an important part of the Tea Party becoming a core constituency or a core part of the support of the Republican Party.
If you didn't look at her name, Hillary Clinton, if you look at Hillary Clinton, if you wiped out her name and just looked at her economic stand, she'd be a Republican.
Well, I disagree. I disagree with that, but she is a moderate Democrat.
If you didn't look at her, if you took out the Tea Party, if you looked at her before 2008.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's very much like her positions are not unlike Bill Clinton's. And Bill Clinton celebrated what he called a third way, which was an attempt to find a position between the Democratic and Republican parties. And that view of American politics was attacked bitterly by Bernie Sanders and his supporters in the campaign.
I love how you said that you said something about how the socialists, who would have ever thought that the socialist Democrat would have ever played a role?
Yeah. Yeah, you were talking about how surprised people were at Donald Trump.
Right. Well,
I must say, I don't know any respectable political scientist or pundit who thought a 70-year-old a senator from Vermont, a self-proclaimed social democrat, a democratic socialist, nevertheless, would so challenge the Hillary machine for the nomination in 2016.
All right, we need to finish up.
These are great times, Rick. We could talk about this all day.
Last comment that we need to know. What are your thoughts on the thing tonight?
have a couple of stiff drinks because it's going to be like watching a very, very bad car crash.
Do you think we're going to get into personal aspects?
Yeah, I'm afraid it's going to be overwhelmingly personal. I mean, if I was Hillary Clinton, I would try to, as Michelle Obama suggested, when Donald Trump goes low, she should try to go high and talk about her vision for the country. But I just fear that's not what's going to happen tonight.
Sid Milkus, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure, Rick. Always fun to be here.
Next week, we'll have Robin Jackson here talking about etiquette, manners.
Or the lack thereof.
She runs a civility school here in Charlottesville. Free invitation to Donald Trump to come for a session. Thanks.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.